Welcome to Playback. I'm Nate.
I'm Brandon.
We are two music producers, and this is the show where we take turns picking albums to discuss. This week, Brandon has picked the album Graceland by Paul Simon. Brandon, why did you pick this album?
Yeah, man. It's one of the greats, you know. I wanted to kind of get our show started. I didn't want to wait too long. You know, get to like episode 25 until we start getting into like the
good albums,
the big ones. Yeah, so like the really good, really great albums that like people know, people love, people want to think about, talk about, listen to again, revisit. It's just, I don't know. It's like in my 10 like favorite albums ever, maybe.
I totally get like why you picked this, like why you picked this.
Me, right.
You specifically.
It's up my alley.
It is just really up your alley. Like, yeah. It's funny to say that because it's so popular and like everyone has like such an affinity for it. But the fact that you have an affinity for it is so clear after listening to it. I'm like, this is such a Brandon album. Like, I get why you love it. I totally get it.
I'm curious as to why. Because this is also an interesting thing. So for this episode, this is the first time that you have ever listened to this album, right?
Yes. Yeah. This is my first time ever hearing this. I'm like kind of embarrassed by that, actually, because I actually love Paul Simon. I have a bunch of his records. This just kind of slipped by me all these years.
Everybody has stuff like that. I do. Everybody has stuff like that. You know, just like the big ones, the big movies you've never seen, the big, you know, like, oh, I never watched The Sopranos or something.
Right.
I've never seen The Godfather, or I've never listened to Graceland, or I've never listened to The Beatles or whatever.
Right. You know? You sound
Everybody's
like
got stuff like that.
You sound like too many of my ex-girlfriends.
Keyword ex.
Yes.
And that's why I'm not with them anymore. No. But what did you think on your first hearing it, your first listen through? What
first
do you think?
First impression. My first impression, okay, because I did manage to squeeze in three listens of this. Brandon was making fun of me because I kind of crammed on this. This show's new. We're still getting used to how we're gonna do it. And even though I had 2 weeks to listen to it, I waited until yesterday.
It's fresh.
I was
a fresh impression.
I feel like my impression of it. I was really like, it was evolving like as I was listening to it. Like my first impression on the first track, which is
The Boy in the Bubble,
was, oh my god, that's like a honking bass sound. And wow, this is really 80s. Like, holy shit. Like,
and holy like, 80s Batman.
Holy 80s. And like, whoa, I don't know if I like the sound of that. Like, what he was playing is obviously really cool, but I was like, I don't know if I like the sound of that.
Yeah.
And even it took me a couple listen throughs to even like that song. Mm-hmm. But I listened to it again this morning and was like, I do like that song. So that was like my initial like gut reaction to this was like that, like, oh man, I don't know if I like the production on this, or like, I don't know if I get it really.
Yeah.
And even I was kind of buying into some of the I found myself, making some of the same criticisms that I think this album faced at the time, which was kind of just like, what the fuck is this rich white dude going to South Africa and making music with these people and essentially just kind of saying, here, I'm going to take what you're doing and now it's mine, right? Now it's a Paul Simon thing, right? Yeah. I kind of found myself falling into that a little bit on my first listen through. But where I arrived at it, like and I think we should talk about all that stuff because it's really interesting, actually.
Yes, we should. We will definitely get to that aspect of it.
Yeah, but where I arrived at it with like my impression of it from listening to it for the first time was that it's just super fun. It is such like a joyous, fun album. It is to me evocative, almost like it almost gives me the same feeling that I get from listening to like Bob Marley records. I don't know if that is just like the African influence in the music, or what it is. to me, it's not really that. It's like the expression of like joy and like festivity and like just like really like enthusiasm for like life and like and like silliness and playfulness. Like, it's not necessarily the same stuff Marley would write about, because Marley was usually really political, and this is like explicitly not political, even though its mere existence is very political, it's which political. Is funny.
Yeah.
But for some reason, it gave me that very like joyous kind of like Buffalo Soldier kind of feeling, like a lot of this album. But yeah, so how about you, Brandon? You're way more familiar with it than me. Although I can already say I'm converted. I love this record. What about you? You've heard it a bunch of times. When was the last time you listened to it, and what was your impression of it this time?
Yeah, last time I listened to it, you know, it's like a couple of days ago. I listened to it a few times in anticipation for recording this, but you know, like even from the first time that I listened to it for this episode, I was like, dude, I could just play this album back in my mind, like verbatim. I've heard it so many times.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And this is definitely one of the few albums for me that I actually can just start at the beginning and just let it play.
Wow.
There's not very many albums that are like that for me. I'm normally skipping through pretty much anything, even some of my favorite albums. Mm-hmm. But it's funny that you bring up your impression of the first song.
Yes.
Just like that, just being slapped in the face with that overly 80s production, right? Because this is 1986. So yeah, this is 86. So if that like quintessential sound of 80s production is like a mountaintop of where it like it progressively got more 80s, and then after a while it started to kind of relax and start to fade away. Mm. Like this album was made at the pinnacle the peak of it, like it, where things were too 80s.
Yeah. And, but know? At the same, I agree, but like, at the same time,
to the point of making them not timeless.
It's at the peak of like when all that was happening. But I also think that this album is like that production style at its most like state of the art, at its most like quintessential. Like if you want like the perfect example of like the gated snare 80s sound, chorus everywhere, just delayed slap things everywhere all over the place, like this is a great example of that production style from the time.
But one of the things that is interesting to me about this album is that it was recorded at many different places at many different times with many different backing bands behind Paul Simon in many different studios with many different engineers. So that means that there's different like levels, different degrees of that 80s-ness sound in different songs.
Yeah.
And I think actually like one of the few there are a couple criticisms that I have, like a few things that I think are kind of like detractors or detractions that you could make about the album. And I think that is one of them, that it opens up with one of the most aggressively 80s sounding things.
Right.
Because that
song was clearly one of the tracks recorded in South Africa. As opposed to like other ones they did with like Los Lonely Boys, which are like definitely in America, and there's definitely recorded in America for those songs, and then there's ones that were like clearly done in like New York City that sound really great, and they're like pop songs. Like Call Me Al is like super pop song to me. And that was one of the New York songs, even though they used the African band, they just brought them to New York. It sounds more New York than the band. But
yeah, it's really interesting how this album is known as the one that was recorded in South Africa.
Right,
but when you look at it, very little of these sounds that are on here were actually recorded there.
Yeah,
you know.
So
and we'll get into that, but
yeah.
But I think though that. Yeah, the choice to open the album with one of the most... So basically, the main like aggressively 80s thing about the songs that have it is it comes down to that snare sound.
Yeah.
It's that snare. It's the psst, 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 yeah. Psst. And it's like...
It's super verbed out. There's so much reverb everywhere.
So it's a snare sample. Okay. So right. the drummer is hitting a thing. So it that can be done of one of two ways. Either the drummer, you know, for his snare drum, he's actually hitting like an electronic pad that triggers right. a sample of a snare, or he's playing a regular drum kit, and then later, you know, the engineers like replace the sound of the snare use the real snare sound to trigger a snare sample that they put in later in the studio.
Right.
You can do that one of those two ways.
But, yeah, it sounds like a computer error sound, like it sounds like all exactly. of a sudden your computer's like bricking.
It exactly like you know to I don't know to my sensibilities it's so not musical, and the way that it's like mixed, it's so out front, it's so prominent, it's so freaking loud.
Yeah,
and the sample that they use, so it's also used in Crazy Love, right? Toward the end, like that same snare sample, and it's like out of phase. Okay, so they like just to talk about what out of phase is probably too deep and too boring and too nerdy, but basically like just basically what it is like the sound waves don't perfectly line up. They're kind of offset a little bit. Okay. But when something is out of phase, it can sometimes have like the psychoacoustic effect of making you feel like motion sickness.
Yeah.
And especially in Crazy Love, the sound of the snare makes me feel nauseous.
Interesting.
When I'm listening to it in headphones.
That's probably, it's probably exacerbated by headphones. It's pumped right into your ears.
Yeah. I don't know if you did a listen through of this in headphones or not.
I did. Okay. I did a sober listen through.
Did the snare make you sound nauseous or feel nauseous?
No, because I was taking I listened to it on vinyl, completely clear minded, and then I took my special herbal anti nausea medicine that helped me. You know, it helped the phase issues.
Administered with a water bomb.
Yes, sure. Uh-huh. but it helped all the phase stuff. So actually I listened to it correctly and you didn't.
So you got yourself in phase with the snare.
I did.
I see. Okay.
So no, but what I did notice was that it was very like aggressive and like annoying. Yeah. It sounds like your computer breaking. So the way this album came about was Paul Simon was friends with Lorne Michaels, who is the guy who runs Saturday Night Live, right? He's super famous, super famous bigwig. And Paul Simon had like an office like across from Lorne's, like in the city, and they would visit each other and have lunch or whatever. And one day, Lorne Michaels said, "Hey, there's one of these singers in the Saturday Night Live band, and she needs some advice because she wants to do like a solo album or whatever. Will you talk to her?" So he did. And they were driving around New York City, and she says, "Hey, play this cassette for me. I want to make an album that sounds like this." And it was the cassette of the band that is on this record, or of one of the bands that is on this record. And so what he did was he played it, loved it, became obsessed with it, called his own label, had them put him in contact with a producer engineer in South Africa. That guy tracked the band down, and then he called up the girl who wanted this to be her album and said, "Yeah, sorry. I'm doing it.
I'm hijacking this idea.
I'm Paul Simon and I'm stealing your idea. I'm taking this idea." So then he decides to go to South Africa. But before he does, he calls up he calls up and tries to get a hall pass from some of his African American friends, one being Belafonte. What the hell's his name?
Harry Belafonte?
Harry Belafonte, thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
Super famous, amazing actor, and like, you know, very involved in like the anti-apartheid movement and the civil rights movement. So he was friends with him and called him like, do you think I should do this? And he said, yes, but you should ask the, I think it's the African National Congress. Is that what they're called? He said,
the ANC.
The ANC. He said, you should. He said, I personally think you should. I think it's a cool idea what you want to do. Because what he wanted to do is go down, hire local African musicians, collaborate with them, and ultimately what he did do that and create Graceland, right? Yeah. But it was controversial because the African National Congress didn't want him to do that because there was, at the time, because of South Africa's apartheid government, there was a cultural boycott put
exactly.
in place.
Yeah.
So because of the cultural boycott, in addition to all the other like boycotts and sanctions that were placed on South Africa, so one of the things was, musicians, anyone who's like has any kind of popular cultural cachet, do not go to South Africa, do not engage with anyone in South Africa, because they were afraid that that would basically add legitimacy to the apartheid government, right?
Yeah,
so it was supposed to be like a complete wall put up between South Africa and the rest of the world. We are going to basically like starve you guys to death culturally, monetarily, you know, any kind of support, you're not getting it.
Right? Yeah. So, and just, you know, I think most everybody knows what apartheid is, but you know, just in case a younger person or whatever, if if you don't know. So yeah, I, at the time, like from, I don't know when it started, like the 30s or the 40s or the 50s or something. It's like a long time ago. And it didn't end until like the 90s. But in South Africa, the government had a system, a policy called apartheid, which, you know, in their language it means like apartness, separateness. It's a governmentally official caste system that is based on race.
Yeah.
So like based on what your race is, like whites are the top class, and then there's like race number two, race number three, race number four, race number five, like that, in terms of what they're allowed to do, what they're allowed to have, and all this stuff. And black people, who are the vast majority, was the bottom rank, and white, which was the smallest number of people, was the top rank.
Yeah.
And so the entire, not the entire world, but 99% of the rest of the governments in the world were like, dude, don't do that. That's fucked up. Stop it. And so they were trying to like starve them out in a demand to like abolish this. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so, so when someone like, or when anyone, let alone a musician, when anyone is like wanting to like participate with them, either culturally or, you know, financially or whatever, that is like helping South Africa be taking part with the rest of the world in any way, they wanted them to, you know, stay in the picket line and join the boycott. Like, don't do that. Starve them out. You know?
It was a solidarity thing. And basically, you know, it'd be one thing if it was just like some guy who broke through the picket line, but it was like a massive superstar that did it.
Because this would give legitimacy to them. This would make people around the world associate South Africa with something like healthy and positive and nice, you know, and like, meanwhile, everybody wanted, you know, everyone to associate South Africa with like a villainous sort of persona.
Yeah. Which was right to do. Like, I mean, like if we're not like spelling out like what apartheid was, like imagine like the worst racism of Jim Crow.
It's horrible.
Era United States, but like, way more overt, way more like top down. Like it is like policy from the top down, like the whole society, like black people, you walk on this side of the street, white people, this is the nice side of the street. Right. Like, it was that kind of shit. Like it's real. I saw some, and you know, just like beatings and riots and just like, it's like horrible shit. Right. And it's like, I don't know. I was like, well, I watched the documentary Under African Skies, which is kind of the like process of like, you know, them making this record and stuff and going down there. It was really interesting because it showed a lot of footage from the time and all that. So it was really fascinating. But it just like struck me like, man, like white people are not from Africa. Like, and there's just this group of white people in the southernmost, like deepest part of Africa, like probably the hardest part of Africa to even fucking get to, or maybe not because of ships or whatever, but like it's like it is so deliberate to be white in South Africa.
Like, at that point, some of them, you know, we're talking like three, four, five generations.
Sure,
you
know? Sure.
It's not like they just arrived.
But
it's not the same as, you know, the Zulu people had been there for countless generations. You know,
right?
Like they were the first people to ever live there. It's not the same thing.
It's just like the deliberate.
Yeah, they were colonizers.
Yeah, the deliberate intentionality of colonizing that area is so apparent and so like blatant, and it's just like fuck. It's like a slap in the face when you see this shit, because it's like, it's like there are these cops there, like they're beating people or whatever, and it's like it really just looks like footage from America, the American South in the 60s. It looks identical to that, but it's like, dude, you're in fucking Africa. Like, what are we doing?
It's heinous.
It's really heinous. Fucked up. Like, you already pointed out, but there's a tiny minority.
Yes.
Tiny minority.
Yes. And this tiny minority used the laws and the police to, like, to make sure that we are in charge and we get the lion's share of everything.
Yeah. You know? Subjugate everyone.
How can we make sure that we have the best and no one can take the best from us? Let's just set up the government to be that way. There, done. Yeah, and the whole rest of the world is like, dude,
what?
You can't do that. So they're like, okay, you can't be in the Olympics anymore. You can't like come to the UN anymore. You can't do all this stuff. Like, nobody will buy your products. And
So part
and eventually it worked. So, you know, eventually they did. They abolished apartheid and things are, you know, the laws aren't like that anymore. But this album was made when it was still very much a thing.
At the height of that shit.
Yeah. And like, so at the height of apartheid being a powerful system there, and at the height of the rest of the world yelling at them.
Yeah.
Like at the height of the argument.
Simon was like, "Hey, I really like this. I really like this kind of noodly song. Where's it from?
I like that sound.
I like that noodly sound from. Yeah. Where's it from?" He even said, "I saw something." He was like, "Would have been a lot easier if this band was from Zimbabwe."
Right, because he had no interest in what's going on other than I like this music. He's like, "This is cool."
Yes.
I'm interested in this sound. I want to play with these guys. And that's like how deeply he thought about it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it like, it wasn't until, you know, the album was coming out and kind of entering the wider conversation when the controversy about it started and he had to start to like defend himself against these accusations of the reasons why this it would be like an unethical album to make in this time and place, you know. But like up until that point he hadn't even thought about that at all. He's just like, this is dope music and I want to play with them.
So this is like crucial, I think, to understand, like, if you hone in on this part of the story, this is like a crucial focal point where maybe you can make your mind up as a listener or an enjoyer of this album, where his heart was when he made this. Because on one hand, you got, well, he stole the idea from this lady. That's how it started, right? And he admits that. Yeah, he admits that full. I mean, he doesn't put it that way. He doesn't say he stole it. But I mean, if you listen to him tell the story, I'm like, okay, so you stole her idea. Like, you totally stole a really good idea. Wow. So it starts from there, and then it leads to, I want to go to apartheid South Africa to make an album with these musicians and like stamp my name on it. So like, if you just look at it from that lens, and on top of that, he doesn't want to make a statement about the politics of what's happening.
Exactly.
So if you look at it through that lens, it's hard to defend in a way. And I see where a lot of people were coming from at the time, where they're like, dude, what the fuck are you doing? You know,
well, I think it's because to most other people at the time, the name of the place was apartheid South Africa, like right. You just said, but to him, the place, it's just South Africa. You know what I mean?
And I mean, it should be noted too. It's not like he was pro apartheid or something, or it's not like he was not against this shit. I mean, I think he had a big problem with it. And he talks about how uncomfortable and gross it was being there. The only time he enjoyed himself was when he was in the studio with the musicians making the music. And even then, he said there was like a ton of tension because the musicians, technically, some of them had never even like hugged a white person before, right? Hmm. Some of them have definitely never played music with a white person before. And even like some of the, he tells a story about like one of the assistant engineers in the studio at the time. They had the first group of South African musicians came in. And he was like, hey, can you guys play this way or something? Mm-hmm. And they tried to do it, but they couldn't really do what he was asking. And then he said, it's cool. Come back. We'll try that idea tomorrow, right? So they come back tomorrow. They still kind of can't really figure it out. And one of the assistant engineers looks at Paul Simon and goes, do you see what we're dealing with? He says, do you see what we're talking about? He's like, he's like, this is what we mean. Like, this is this. They can't. They're not good enough. Like,
assistant engineer was a white guy.
He's a white guy saying to Paul Simon, like, see,
whoa,
see,
oh my God,
fucking insane. Right. And Paul Simon was just like,
Jesus.
He said he was like, just flabbergasted by him saying that.
Wow.
And then he said,
wow.
And then he said, but they had slated like another group to come in. And that's the group that is kind of more, both bands are on the album, but I think there's one that is more than the others, and they're the ones that are like kind of famous for playing on this.
Yes, yeah, we'll get to them. We'll talk about those guys and the different backing bands that are on this. We'll get into that for sure.
But so those guys came in and they like nail it, right? They're like amazing. They're like the best band in the country, and they really impressed everyone. And Paul Simon just goes, he's like, the insidiousness of the culture there was to the point where like they were spoon feeding me this racist shit, and he was like, I almost was like gonna buy into this, like, wow. Like he's like, I can't believe it, but I almost like bought into this shit,
just because of how seriously pervasive they believe it.
Yeah, yeah. How pervasive it was
in the air.
So I mean, wow. and like, wow. To the point where like the musicians had curfews, right? They weren't allowed to be out past a certain point. So like when the sessions went long, they would all be sitting there like, fuck, like I can't take, I gotta go home tonight. I can't take public transportation. I can't technically be seen on the street. Like, what the fuck am I gonna do? You know? So like they just were faced with like so many external stressors by the system in place in that country.
So they had to break the law to be make the record. This album.
Yeah, I mean, essentially.
Wow.
And you know, but like, so there's something I wrote down because when you hear Paul Simon defend his decision to make this record, it actually, because like I said, I kind of had my own, the criticisms of this album, I kind of arrived at on my own. And then when I saw them being addressed at him at the time, I was kind of like, yeah, man, like, I get why people feel that way. But he actually lobbies a pretty amazing defense that actually...
What does he say?
I like, believe it. This is how I feel about it now. His kind of core defense is there's like a societal hierarchy, right? There is politicians. There are kind of the money behind politicians, all the big mysterious money that like makes up who gets elected.
Rich people.
Then there are like, you know, economists. Then there's like, you know, military warrior class, defense people. And then down the line is maybe, you know, probably more rich people, blah, blah, blah. And like all the way down the line, it's artists, right? And what politicians
poor
do.
Poor people.
Yeah. Yeah. What politicians do is they say they will take an artist and they will put them at a rally or something, for instance, right? And it's like they basically take all the goodwill and love and, you know, support that like artists get, and they say, since you're performing for me in my rally or at my event or whatever, like by association, all the support you get as an artist for your music is now mine. Like, it is now mine, right?
They co-opt the support. They co-opt the love that the people have for the artist onto themselves as a politician.
Yes.
Okay.
And so he says, I have a huge problem with that. And two, he says, you know, the morality that comes from music is its universality, right? It's like a language that we all understand without having to speak. There's only 12 notes. We all know them. We all share them. That's it. There, all the other differences are pretty like minor when you look at it in the face of like music, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, he would talk about how like, you know, the politician's morality comes from like the barrel of a gun, right? And musician's morality emanates from like this, the deepest well and spirit of like humanity and like what makes being alive beautiful and amazing. And I wrote something down. I wrote my thought down. I just wrote down, this album showcases the impotency of politics and politicians in the face of music.
Holy shit.
Like, there is no more powerful force in society or on the world to like unite people than music. That's why they use artists for their own gains, for their own means, right?
Because that's why they use them.
They don't have it.
They need to go to the artist to get that.
Yeah. Or they just often do. You know, I mean, you see it all the time. Yeah. Look at that, was like half of Kamala Harris's campaign was like paying like a different pop star every day to like perform at her rallies, you know? And it's like that's what they do, right?
Yeah.
And so he was just basically saying like if music is like a universal, like borderless like community, who is any politician to tell me, the artist, what to do, and to tell us, the artists, what to do? And guess what? All these critiques you're levying against me, all the musicians on this album would disagree with you. They would say it is a collaboration. It's not it's not appropriation, right? It is a true collaboration. And like watching it, I do kind of, watching them make it, like I do kind of feel that way. I mean, it's obviously a Paul Simon album, but like, man, you don't get this album without the contributions of these band members.
Exactly.
He couldn't do it. Like, he didn't know how to play this shit, you know?
Exactly, man. Fiery, political and artistically philosophical, this is a good look on you. I like it. We'll be right back. Okay. All right, let's talk about the music shit now. Let's get like, it's like who are the musicians on here? Because this is not, so again, like I feel like the way that this album is understood to people is sort of simplified. Like, oh, this is the one where Paul Simon went to South Africa and recorded with a South African band and made this album, right? And yeah, it's yes, but it's more complex than that. There's like four or five different configurations of a backing band behind Paul Simon on this record. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are one-offs, right? Where there is like a cohesive lineup of musicians that were playing as his band on one song and only one song. The two most prominent ones of that are the last two songs down at the end. And those two songs have
Los Lobos, right?
Only the last song, All Around the World, or the Myth of Fingerprints. That's with Los Lobos, who's a band from LA. And the second to last song, That Was Your Mother, is a band from Louisiana, whose name I can't remember right now.
It was like a Zydeco band.
A Zydeco band, exactly. Yeah. So those two songs have I'm almost positive have no African musicians on them at all.
Yeah.
Right. So
and yet they fit the album really well.
Okay, yeah, because to me I don't know. I kind of don't think that they do. That's another one of the like criticisms that I have is like
I think his idea,
like, dude, you ran almost the whole marathon this one cohesive concept, like this is Paul Simon vibing with South African music and African musicians. We should get into that too. Not all of the musicians are from South Africa. There's also other guys involved, but like, you know, you got almost to the finish line with this like this totally cohesive idea, but then at the end it's like, oh, but let me do a Louisiana song and one more song with a band from LA, and we'll just tack it on at the end. Literally at the end.
Right, when they were
the
done.
Last two songs.
Yeah, yeah.
It's sort of like, why? Why
I not will just say,
let it be what it is. You know?
Yeah. I will say those are probably my two least favorite songs.
Yep, mine too.
I don't think that they like. I don't think that they detract from the album too much.
And they're good.
They're good. And I don't think that I do think that they fit relatively well, because like, even though it's not the same musicians, and for like nerds like us, we could probably hear that, like there's stuff they do with the African musicians earlier in the album that is in a lot of ways, like if you squint, almost trying to do the stuff that's on those last two songs, right? Like Graceland is like, it's not like a train beat and it's not a country song.
Okay.
But like, if you squint, it is.
Okay.
You know? Yes. And then at the end, the Boy in the Bubble, it has accordion on it, right? So then when you bring it back full circle, it's like African musicians like trying to approximate American music, which I think they would all say, like a lot of their ideas they had to bring to Paul Simon was like, they were trying to do what an American band would do. And then I think his idea was to, I mean, it's called Graceland too. I think his idea was to bring it back full circle to America, right? And in a way kind of show like, yeah, it's not that different. Like, it's not.
Well, the name Graceland, so in a quintessentially Paul Simon way, it literally, just singing that word Graceland over this song, just what was like a random word,
right?
Is how it originated. It's just,
it was a placeholder,
just some random word, a placeholder that he just started to say, oh, I'm going to Graceland. He had never even been to Graceland,
right,
in his life. Graceland, by the way, is it's Elvis Presley's mansion, right?
Elvis Presley's home,
Elvis Presley's home in Memphis, Tennessee.
And he only went there after Carrie Fisher of Star Wars fame divorced him. And he needed a road trip to clear his head, so he did.
Because he had already written this song and started singing it and started recording it, and he's like,
maybe it should be Graceland.
I guess I should go there
to
see what it is that I'm singing about for no reason.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I feel like that's such a Paul Simon thing. He's such an interesting songwriter in that way, because he's like this total blend and this total mix of
he's a music
gibberish
nerd
and deep meaning intermixing. Yeah. You know,
yeah,
lyrics that are like very profound and like mean a lot, that can like reach into the hearts of people,
but they're kind of silly
intermixed with just shit that is just,
yeah,
he just likes the sound of it and it literally means nothing,
right?
You know,
yeah.
So I think that's how Graceland started, and that is the origin of why the whole project is called Graceland.
I mean, calling it, it's honestly brilliant name on so many levels, because
it turns out that it is perfect, and it turns out that it works, and so he kept it and like sort of found out how perfect it is after the fact of singing it.
I mean, Graceland is basically the rock and roll mecca, right? It's like like every musician talks about it. Like every musician you've ever met has said at one point or heard at one point, I have to go, you got to go to Graceland. You have to just do it. It's like music mecca.
It's a pilgrimage.
It's a pilgrimage that every musician does at some point in their life, or at least you're kind of meant to think you should, right?
He even says it in the lyrics. Was it poor boys and pilgrims with families we're all going to Graceland or something like that.
And then, so it's like, it kind of implies this like spiritual like quest or pilgrimage that he's on. And he associates that with a place that we in America, like, it makes sense and we understand it. But set to the backdrop of African music recorded in the literal cradle of humanity, literally where humanity emanated from, right?
Yeah.
Which, in a lot of ways, probably should be a place where every human, like, visits at some point or another.
It makes a pilgrimage too.
And it's like this beautiful, it's a beautiful place. It is a gorgeous part of the world, right? So it's so evocative of like these like heavenly images that you now associate and like spiritual, like all this big beautiful stuff that now you're associating with Africa. Like, it's really wonderful. Like, it's like kind of amazing.
It is. It's very profound. It's a really interesting thing how such a like shallow, surfacey thing of just like, oh, I like the sound of that word. I'll figure out what I'm actually going to sing later.
Yeah.
I'm not going to sing that.
Oh, I like this cassette tape. Where are they from? Queens?
Yeah.
Oh.
But it turns out to be this like super
amazing,
like rich metaphor. You know?
Like God came down and touched you, Paul Simon, with this idea.
I'm going to bust out the guitar now.
Mm. Yes.
Let me bust out the guitar. Because the song, like you said something earlier, which was that, like Paul Simon said, like, dude, if you, like those of you who say that, like, I just showed up and appropriated their music, like all of these guys who played on this, like they would not agree with you.
Right. Yeah, they would say no.
So them recording this album was a process of each of them learning from each other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Undoubtedly, obviously, Paul Simon learned a lot about the way that they play music, and they taught him a lot of new stuff, right?
And it was vice versa. They talked about
exactly. It was vice versa, right?
Yeah.
There was a lot of what was happening musically in this album and to play it that was new to them, and they learned a lot and ended up incorporating that in their music, because all of these guys are professional recording artists.
Yeah.
You know, these are not just guys hanging out in the neighborhood and Paul shows up
and hires them.
These are like established, famous, successful recording artists.
And funnily enough, didn't really know who he was when he showed up.
Yeah,
like,
really?
Like they didn't know shit about this guy. They were just like, what is this fucking weird little white guy doing in the studio?
That's
like,
awesome.
Who is this guy? They said it took a couple days, and then they were like, oh, fuck, this guy's like a really big deal.
Okay, so one of the things that...
You were saying earlier that probably the second most important person on this record is, I'm going to pronounce his name wrong, but it's the main guitar player.
Yeah, so it's, how to pronounce his name is an interesting thing, because the way that Paul Simon says his name is Ray Peary.
Yeah.
But I remember a very good friend of mine, the percussionist Al Keith, who I played in a bunch of bands with him. He played a couple times in Ray Peary, his band, like toured with him. And he always used to call him Ray Fury. Oh. Ray Fury.
Okay.
So it's pronounced P-H-I-R-I. So I don't know if it's Ray Fury or Ray Peary.
It's one of those.
But yeah. Probably. Okay. So since this is the Paul Simon freaking episode, we'll go with his just for the sake of picking something. Ray Peary.
So you're going to play as
genius guitar player. So this, by the way, going back to the question, why did I pick this album? Like just the part of the origins of why I'm obsessed with this album and why I've listened to it so many times and why I love it so much is because of Ray Peary and his guitar playing. This dude is amazing. His ideas, like his sensibility, the way his sensibility of melody is freaking addictive to me.
Yes. And it's done in a way that is like, there's a pattern, but you can't really identify it. It's hard to find like where it loops.
It's
intricate guitar playing.
Yeah. It's intricate. It's detailed. It's fast. Mm-hmm. It's so precise.
Yes.
Okay. Like for example,
it's syncopated. Some of the syncopation he does is like amazing.
The little intro guitar lick to get into Diamonds on the Soles of Your Shoes. I've been for like a week. I've been trying to learn how to play this lick. I can't do it. So yeah, I'm gonna try it. But it's see. Okay. Listen to the record.
Yeah.
When he plays, it is so precise and accurate. Every little detail of every note is so controlled. The rhythm is perfect. The articulation of the pick is so flawless.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got this like muscle memory for this, and it's so like counterintuitive to me and to my ear and my sensibilities of playing guitar.
My favorite. He really nailed the tone of his sound. It's very good.
Yeah,
it really does sound like the record. My favorite is probably the Graceland guitar part. That's the one that I'm just like, fuck. I think there's like a syncopated syncopated line he does in that
I don't know how to play that part.
That's my favorite.
The chorus, the thing that the Ray Peary's guitar, the bass. Okay, we have to have a whole discussion on the bass player. Okay.
Do you remember when I said I could identify immediately why you love this album?
Uh huh.
It's because it's a bass album.
It is.
It's a bass album.
We'll get to him. Okay.
I mean guitar too, but
Bagidi Kumalo, the bass player. Mm-hmm. Oh my god. Okay. Just finish talking about the guitar player first because he's a whole other thing. But going back to the song Graceland and this idea of how they're learning from each other.
Mm.
Okay, so did you hear the story about the minor chord?
He decided to play a relative minor chord in that song because he thought it was like something that they would do in America.
Exactly. So they had the drum beat that drum beat that is similar to like a classic country drum beat.
Yes.
But isn't. It's actually like a South African drum beat that has a name.
Yeah.
Right. And so they had that, and Paul, they're in the studio, and Paul Simon knows that he wants to do something with this beat and asks Ray Peary to start playing something, come up with, what do you got for this, you know? So it's a recurring theme that, like, for the musical tradition that these guys are coming from, they hear things primarily, and in some cases exclusively, in a major key. Okay.
Yeah, so, I remember hearing somebody say something like, in their traditional style, there's really only like three major chords.
Exactly. And they are one, yeah, four, five. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's all that the blues is. That's all that, like, maybe more than 50% of
music
is. Is those three chords. Okay. Even Diamonds on the Soles of Your Shoes, is the whole song is 1-4-5, right? Wait, let's see. So, four, five.
Yep.
Right. Okay. So that is like their musical template that they hear in their minds, right? Mm. So, they have this country like drum beat for Graceland, and he asks Ray Peary to start playing something. And he plays this chord. There's the one. And then he goes to the four. But then he goes, that's the minor chord right there.
Right.
There's like a new kind of flavor, kind of like a little bittersweetness, a little sadness in there. And then the five chord.
Yeah.
So he adds that in. And Paul Simon at that point had already been hanging out with these musicians enough to know that is kind of out of the ordinary, because he had been already working with Ladysmith Black Mambazo, the vocal group who we need to talk about them too.
Yeah.
And they had like trouble singing a minor chord because of how unfamiliar it was to them. And so he noticed, hey, you played that minor chord. How come? Why did you play that? And Ray Peary was basically like, he's like, well, I've been listening to your music, and that seems like something that you would do in your song. So I thought, let's try it out. You know? And yeah, so it really is like,
it was something he would do, because he did it.
It totally is. And but it's trippy though, because it's like a quintessentially Paul Simon chord shape, but it was written by Ray Peary.
Yeah.
Emulating. So Paul Simon is there writing Paul Simon music, emulating African musicians, and the African musicians are in there making Paul Simon music, emulating Paul Simon.
Yeah,
right. So everybody's learning. Everybody's getting out of their comfort zone.
Yeah,
it's awesome.
So talk to me about the bass player. That's what I want to talk to you about.
Bigidi Kumalo.
Bigidi Kumalo.
This dude who played this fretless bass. Okay, you know, normally a bass that you hear on these albums, they have frets. So, you know, the little metal things on the neck of it. So what that does is it makes each note be kind of isolated and specific, like piano keys, you know?
Right.
Ding, 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 you know, up, 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 up. This one. So, Bigidi Kumalo, he is playing a fretless bass. So it's just a smooth piece of wood. So all the slides and transitions between notes are just one continuous thing, like a stand-up bass.
Right.
You know, like those big ones. That
boing, yeah.
Boing, and that's what gives it that slidey vibe.
And the benefit of frets, which makes playing a fretless bass even harder, is frets are your notes, right? They delineate where your notes are, right?
They assist you.
Yeah. If you don't have frets, then you just have to know where the right note is. You just have to be able to feel it, and you have to be really knowledgeable of your instrument.
Muscle memory.
Yeah.
The combination of your muscle memory from all your practice in combination with your ear to make sure that your note that you're playing is on the right pitch the whole time.
Yeah.
So this dude is just like an unbelievably skilled,
yes,
and gifted with an ear, the sensibility, like the things that he plays are mind-blowing to me. And then you mentioned in The Boy in the Bubble, the very first song, so that's actually not him, Or no, sorry, that is him playing bass.
I was going to say, it has to be him.
Yeah, it is. But the reason why, for a second, I thought that it wasn't is because The Boy in the Bubble, that is yet another band.
Hmm. Yes.
From South Africa that has a name. Bigidi Kumalo happens to be in that band.
Right.
But the reason why I thought that it might not be him is because, you know, this isn't like a one-man style. You know, this is not, he isn't like the only bass player that plays like that or that sounds like that. It's like an established thing.
Yeah.
Because South African music, or these styles of South African music are very bass forward.
Right.
Right. The guitar is tucked in the back and the bass is super loud and prominent and playing a very prominent melodic part, which is backwards from how American music is. The bass is in the background and the guitar is rocking out front.
Yeah.
And taking all of your attention.
Support thing.
Exactly. So in these styles, it's the opposite. The guitar is supporting and the bass is much more prominent.
Yeah.
And so,
and even Paul Simon, he talked about, because I think we'll get into this more when we talk about the production specifically, but he said when trying to compose lyrics to this material, like, he made the mistake of trying to think of it in like the verse, chorus, verse kind of dichotomy that we all think about when we write a song or when, you know, Western musicians write a song. Mm-hmm. But he said that like the problems he would have would be like, why do the lyrics work on verse one and then they don't fit in verse two? It's the same part. And then he said what he would do is he would just turn the bass up and listen to what the bass player was doing. And he was saying, oh, because it's actually a slightly different pattern. Like, that's how intricate these guys are. And it said the same thing about the guitar player too. But he specifically mentioned the bass as being like, if I don't let the bass dictate where the song's going, then this is going to feel really like incongruous to itself, right?
Exactly.
So, to the point where he basically said, I'm going to throw out like normal song structure for the most part, even though these songs sound so natural and so beautifully composed that like it doesn't hit you in that way. Like this is some like radically different thing. But if you really look under the hood of these songs, like that is what's going on. Like it's like it's almost like a weird nonlinear kind of writing style that he had to do.
Exactly. So when you listen to Diamonds on the Soles of Your Shoes, for example, the drums and the guitar are just basically just playing a loop. They're just doing the same thing. It's just those chords over and over, you know, he's just playing that line. And so what determines what tells Paul Simon, okay, when is the pre-chorus, right? When is the part where he goes, and I could say, woo.
Yeah, yeah.
It's when the bass starts.
Yep.
Right? And then, when does the horn line happen? When do the horn players start playing the... When do they do that? Well, it's when the bass starts doing the...
Yeah, the bass completely informs the song structure.
Meanwhile, the guitar...
Yep.
Just doing that the whole time. The whole time. So, and so in... And again, in their musical styles, that's normal.
Yeah.
The bass is in charge, which for us is completely backwards. If there's one in American music, if there's one instrument that is not in charge, it is the bass.
Right. And again, that's why I immediately knew that this was like a Brandon album. I was like, oh man, listen to the bass on this shit. Like this is a Brandon album.
Yeah, dude. Give the bass player power. It's amazing.
Yeah. So yeah, he's probably, I think arguably the second most important musician. I mean, you could put him and Ray together really, or whole rhythm section even.
The reason why I say that Ray was the second most, I mean that in terms of like a behind the scenes thing. Like, because he was the band leader.
Right.
You know, he was the musical director. He was like had a hand in arranging a lot of the songs. I mean, he wrote a lot of the music. True. Even though it says all tracks written by Paul Simon.
No, yeah, he shares writing credits on quite a few songs with
people. Oh,
does he? Yeah, he does. Okay. He does.
Well, we need to update this Wikipedia then, which is where I get all my information.
Yeah.
But in terms of just in the sound, yeah, when you listen to it, who's the second most important thing going on here? Yes, the bass.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And then you can't, bass guitar, Paul Simon, obvious, but like you can't skip over, what are they called again? Lady Black Mambazo.
Lady Smith Black Mambazo.
So they
Holy crap.
They are
Holy crap.
A vocal group.
Yes.
And they are like a famous vocal group in South Africa. They were famous in that time period. They'd apparently actually been around since like the 60s. They were like very famous in South Africa. Obviously, Graceland introduced them to like a whole new stratosphere of audience. Yeah. To the point where like a popular thing in South Africa apparently was they would have vocal group competitions, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And they would always win because they were the best and they were known as the best, to the point where at post Graceland, competitions no longer allowed them to compete. They were only allowed to participate. Like they could come and sing and do their thing, but like they're not in competition because they're so much better than all the other vocal groups in South Africa.
So in my research for this episode, I learned two new things about them, which is pretty amazing. One is their name. So it's three words. What the hell do those mean? Lady Smith, Black Mambazo. So
right,
Smith is like the town or the city or the neighborhood where they're from or whatever. Mm-hmm. But what Mambazo means, apparently, is it's like an axe of some sort, like a hatchet. And basically, they picked that name because they want their competition, they want their opponents in every singing competition to know, we are going to destroy you. We are going to chop you down.
Wow.
We are the Ladysmith Black Mambazo. Like, we are the axe, and we're going to F you up, and we're going to dominate and win this competition.
That's so funny.
And and in the song, we have to talk about the song Homeless.
Yes. Well, let's. Oh, yeah, we can talk about it right now.
My God.
That's their showcase. That's like their big showcase on the
exactly.
record.
Exactly. But the very end of the song, there's like that little tag of a thing of like a solo singer going da na 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 I would like to introduce ourselves. We are Ladysmith Black Mambazo, and we will be the greatest singing band in the country, and we will destroy you. And that's how the song ends.
Wow, that's awesome. That is awesome.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so, so they're like... They're like really amazing, and like they were like a family. You get the feeling like they brought like, because there was female singers too, and they would like bring their kids in the studio, and like it was like they would show up, and it was just like a party. Like when they would arrive, and like they're kind of like, if the musicians we've already talked about are kind of like, they're like the heart and the brain of this stuff, I would say they're like the brain and the backbone of this stuff is what they are. They're like the mechanics of how it works. They are
the spine.
They're like the structure and like the thought process and mechanics of the record. Ladysmith Black Mambazo is like the heart and like the soul and like the spirituality of this music, and obviously Paul Simon too, but like I think having African voices on this record, like kind of, it teleports this to like a whole nother stratosphere of like, just absolutely impeccable music. Like,
It's,
and they're used so tastefully, like it's so well, like how they're incorporated. It's just like, because it's like, they're a vocal group. It's so genius because like on the same song, he's like, I'm going to call the Everly Brothers because, you know, I was in Simon and Garfunkel and they were our heroes. It's like for him, in the same way that he took this African music that was like very, reminiscent of like, you know, country music, he takes these African singers and uses them in a way that's very reminiscent of like Simon and Garfunkel.
Exactly.
And the Everly Brothers. Yes. It's
right.
It is
in the tradition of American vocal harmony.
Every instance of using these musicians on this record is in service of that flipping that relationship, right?
Yes.
Or reinterpreting American music through African musicians. It is so brilliant.
It is, and they have an opportunity to show up in both contexts, because it's so trippy to me how prominent Ladysmith Black Mambazo is, how prominent their presence is on this album. They're on two songs.
Right.
They're in Diamonds and the Soles of Her Shoes, and they do Homeless.
Whoa.
Right? It seems strange, because you listen to this album, exactly, you feel like you've been listening to them all day.
Wow.
They're in two songs. That's how
their
presence is felt.
When they show up, it is like a massive presence they have. Like, it's crazy. Yes. And yet, maybe their footprint is so large that you mistake it for being all over the album, because I certainly did. I'm blown away that you just pointed out that they're only on two songs.
They're only on two songs. So there's the song I Know What I Know that also has African singers there, but that's a different group.
Different group. Gotcha.
Yeah, that's somebody else. But
you're right that those two songs are like the standout vocal songs.
Yes.
Those are the two.
But it's really cool because, they're like employed in a way that recontextualizes the African vocal harmony in a way that like American vocal harmony is done in Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes. Mm-hmm. Right. Even though it opens like with a full on, a cappella thing, but then they sing together. They're singing together. It's the American singer backed up by the African singers, and it's seamless. They meet in the middle. It's both of their styles at the same time.
And it works. It makes sense.
It works fucking perfectly.
And they did sing it all live together in a room all at once. That's so how they recorded it. I watched a video of them recording it, and they were like, basically, the African musician, they came to New York. The Ladysmith Black Mambazo came to New York City. They were so like foreigners in a foreign land that they actually asked for a permit to walk down the street before they went outside. That's how fucking like ingrained like the apartheid system was in their brains. They were like, can we go to the park? Do we need a permit to go to Central Park? And he was like, no. Like, just go.
Wow.
Like, it's the first time they'd ever experienced that. So they were like extremely grateful to be there, extremely gracious, extremely happy, like infectiously happy. And they said they were so nervous to do that they like, before they went to the session, they like said a prayer together. And they like, it was like really, really intense, because they were like, we've never, like, as a group, we're the best, and we've never failed at anything, and this is the biggest moment of our lives, and we cannot fail right now.
Wow.
And so they went to the recording session thinking that Paul Simon might not even be there. And not only was he there, they were thinking, okay, we're just going to record Homeless, and then he'll overdub it later, his stuff. He'll just do stuff later. He was basically conducting.
He sang with them.
He was essentially kind of conducting them, although not really. I wouldn't necessarily use that term. He was there, and then he just stepped up and just started singing along with them, and it surprised them. And that's like what's on the record, as far as I can tell.
Jesus Christ.
Pretty incredible, man.
Shivers.
Yeah. Like moving shit. Really incredible.
Goose pimples.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Very moving. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. And, I'm so happy. Like the first time that I listened to the album, right? Because it's going on. You hear Boy in the Bubble, Graceland, Know What I Know, Gumboots, Diamonds, Call Me Al, Under African Skies. It's going on, and you're like, you're understanding the concept of this album, what this is. It's like this marriage of American music and South African music. You can hear it, you know, and it's like, this is so great. And then the eighth song comes around, and I'm so fucking glad that they did this, which is, there's a moment where it's featured on its own, you know, like where he lets them be them.
Right.
On that song. you know?
Yeah.
And even though it is still a collaboration. So, but like Diamonds on the Soles of Your Shoes, that's Ladysmith Black Mambazo coming into this, you know, like rock and roll context or something, you know, there's a full band playing and they're singing along with it, you know, like them doing their thing, being incorporated into something. But Homeless is the other way around.
Right.
Homeless is Paul Simon now being the minority, being mixed into their, it's prominent, more prominently their style, but it's still a mix.
Right.
There's, he's there singing in English. They're call and response back and forth with each other.
Right.
But like, I feel that if that song wasn't on this album, like it would be, well, okay. Because the song is on the album, it has a power that it wouldn't have otherwise.
I think so too. Yeah.
You know,
if it was
all drums and bass guitar songs and nothing but, like,
it's a standout moment on the album. Like, for sure. It's the heart. It's like the heart of the record for me. I think this all kind of dovetails into some stuff about the production I'd love to hit on.
Okay.
Which is that the way this album was like constructed, because it was constructed. This album was, he didn't like go to Africa and like sing Graceland with them.
Right.
He went down there. He learned from them. They learned from him. They played, they jammed. And basically they had this glut of material, of rhythms and all this crazy shit that they played.
And not vocals.
And no vocals.
That's the thing that trips me out. And I think I learned that like just during this this deep dive now for this episode. I don't think I ever knew that.
Yeah.
I always assumed that they got together and he either had the lyrics or he wrote the lyrics there in the sessions with them. No. All these Paul Simon vocal parts happened after the fact.
Not only after the fact, but it's like,
it's really interesting.
The structure of the songs was not even there during the sessions, right? Like what they had to do was,
oh, he didn't say, okay, now let's put a chorus here.
No, it was not like that at all. Basically, these African musicians, they did what they do. They came up with these cool grooves and rhythms and jams and all the stuff you hear. But what they did was they took the tapes. And this is one of the earlier instances of them using digital editing technology. They actually took the analog tapes and they dumped them onto like a very early version of probably something we would recognize as Pro Tools today, but it wasn't Pro Tools yet. But it was like a digital audio workstation.
Okay. In 85 or 86, that is like very,
very
new technology.
Ahead of the curve.
Yes.
And so basically
that didn't become commonplace until like the mid to late 90s.
So it's the engineer Roy Halley, who was Paul Simon's longtime engineer. Basically, dude's like a genius because what he did is he did this. I probably with Paul Simon, I would think. He went through, found stuff in all these recordings and was like, okay, this is basically could be a chorus. Okay, now I'm going to take this other part.
I didn't know that.
I'm going to take this.
I had no idea.
Yeah, like, okay, this could be a verse. And then he would like present it to Paul Simon. Then Paul Simon would take those like constructed edits and then he would listen to them on headphones. And then that's how he wrote the melodies and the lyrics and all their, maybe he had the melodies, but that's definitely how he wrote the lyrics to all these songs. So it was like fully like constructed in the studio, in post-production really. And I found that to be really interesting because one of the only like touch points I felt like I had for this record was Remain in Light by Talking Heads, because And also David Byrne's like a huge fan of this record, which I was very happy to learn, and makes total sense.
That's another thing that we need to talk about before we're done is how this influenced other people.
But yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and the reason I bring up Remain in Light is because it's a really similar record in a lot of ways. It's basically the Talking Heads discovered a similar style of like African music. And what they did is they tried to learn how to play it, and they played it themselves, and they would do it in a really similar way. They basically went into the studio, they constructed these jams. They would just jam on like cool, they would just discover like cool rhythms that they really liked. And then Brian Eno and the post-production team, David Byrne and all them, what they would do is they would basically cut up the sections, reorganize them into like verse, chorus, bridge type of songs. And then David Byrne wrote and recorded all the vocals for it. And they did all the vocals after the fact. Because like my thing was like, okay, there's no way Graceland is like that, right? I have a feeling that they just went into the studio.
That's what it feels like.
Yeah.
The finished product of Graceland feels so organic.
Yes.
It just feels like...
Yes.
Like what the story is. Like the simplified version of the story. It's like, oh, Paul Simon went to South Africa and got in a studio with some musicians and made this. Sounds like.
And I would say...
But it's not at all in reality.
I would say Remain in Light doesn't sound organic. It does sound constructed and like it's dark, and it has these cool African rhythms and grooves to it. Influenced
by that stuff. I
gotta
look at Remain in Light, like which songs are on there.
That's like their big one. It's the one with their blue and red like cover.
Okay. Once in a Lifetime, Houses in Motion, Cross-Eyed and Painless. Okay,
it's great. It's like one of their best. It's probably their best.
Yeah, it is. Once in a Lifetime.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the days go by. Yeah, exactly. Right. So, but it does feel like super, that one feels like super overdub heavy and like constructed in a way that this does not, weirdly. Yeah. This one really feels like you can get the sense that he like built on those production techniques that were kind of maybe established or something. Like,
so all of that is a testament to Roy Halley.
Yes.
Haley Halley.
Yes.
And the skill, because to make doing all this surgical shit and all these different aspects of the production being done at different times and sort of out of order of what you would think they would be done, and to have the end result feel so cohesive and so natural,
yes,
that is a testament to that engineer's skills.
That's right, why there.
I think how that is done. That doesn't come about by the genius of Paul Simon.
This album is also like a testament to leaving artists the fuck alone and like letting them do what they want to do. Like the one he did right before this, was like a big like critical and commercial flop for him. It was like, I think it's called like Blood and Bones or something.
Hearts
and Bones.
I've never heard it either.
But it was his first flop since starting Simon and Garfunkel, really. He talks about that as being like studio executives just being over his shoulder, being like, is this the hit? Is this song going to be the hit song? Which song is going to be the hit? Is this the hit? Like, oh, we have to make it sound like this. We have to make it sound like that. And it's just all these fucking dumb, like middlemen, idiot, like non-artists, like telling Paul Simon, like what his album should sound like. Like, dude, stay in your fucking lane. Like, please. And he talked about the fact that was a flop was like majorly freeing for him, because it allowed him to do something insane, like go to Africa and make an album with these African musicians that he wouldn't have been able to do if his album before was a big hit. They would have like, and they even told him before he did this one, they were like, you don't have to go to Africa for that. There's like fucking awesome session players in New York. Just get one of those guys. And like, to Paul Simon's credit.
You want to play these African styles? That's fine. Get the session players and teach them how to play it.
Call Bob.
Yeah.
And to his credit, he was like, he was like, no, I need to go. If I want my music to sound like a certain thing, I need to go to where that thing is happening and go do it and go use the people that do it, right? Mm-hmm. And to his credit, I don't even think people really think of it this way. This isn't even the first time he did this.
Really?
Dude, there goes Ryan and Simon, his second solo record, which is fucking awesome, by the way. It's okay. The same. It's literally the same idea. That one has Kodachrome on it and a couple other really good songs. It's the same idea. It's just less overt because it's done in like an American style. He's like, he went to Muscle Shoals and he just used all the Muscle Shoals people, right? He was like, I want my record to have a certain sound. Well, guess I have to go to Muscle Shoals for that because that's the place where it's happening, right?
So it was the same thing, but instead of working with South African musicians, he's working with musicians from Alabama.
Yeah, he's going and doing like swamp rock shit. Yeah,
oh, that's cool.
It's the same thing, and that album rocks. That album is not a sleepy Paul Simon album. That album fucking kicks ass. I would say anybody who listens to this one and wants more of this type of Paul Simon exploring, styles and juxtaposing his style with like kind of opposing music. There goes Ryan Simon, dude. Holy shit. It's
okay,
awesome.
I got to check that out. I haven't listened to that one. And also, too, in a similar vein, the album that he did after
Graceland. Yeah, it's like a Brazilian thing, right?
Yeah, the Rhythm of the Saints.
I have not listened to that one, though.
It's a similar concept, except that the music in question is from Brazil and also from West Africa.
I really want to hear that one now.
Yeah.
Even though I would say that, like, to do that following Graceland so soon, it feels a little contrived, and I think I would be surprised if it's like as cool as Graceland. I really would be.
Yeah, because part of the appeal and part of what is so cool and effective about Graceland is the unexpectedness of it, is the quality of it coming out of nowhere and like having no precedent, like the world was not asking for it, kind of a thing.
Yeah,
you know. And so I see what you mean. We're like, oh, well, guess what he's doing on his next album? I'm going to do the same thing with another culture. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. It's a little like, that's where, again, the criticisms of Graceland start to pop up again. And you start wondering, like, what is your motivation, motherfucker? Like,
yeah,
what?
Right. Are you just a musical colonizer? Is that, which is a valid question.
I think it is, too. It's a really, I think... do your own research on this record and arrive at your own conclusions.
Now you're a real podcaster.
Yeah, now we're real podcasters.
You've told the listeners to do their own research.
Yeah.
We're officially a podcast.
Yeah. Paul Simon says the earth is flat. Paul Simon's Chemtrails is his last album.
I feel dirty now.
Yeah, yeah. I think very quickly we should do like standout songs, even though we've already talked in
depth. How long have we been talking?
I would say within the next 10 minutes we should be out.
Okay. I like how you strategically don't tell me how long we've been talking. Okay.
This is going to be a long episode. Quickly, what are the one or two standout songs for you on this one?
Okay. Well, for me, and I think most folks would agree with me that like the best songs, the dopest songs are the ones from those New York sessions with the all-star rhythm section of Ray Peary and Bigidi Kumalo and the drummer whose name I can't remember, Isaac something. Mm-hmm. Isaac Michali, the drummer. Which are Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes, You Can Call Me Al. Mm-hmm. Dude, come on. You Can Call Me Al. How have we not talked about this song?
So
Under African Skies. Dude, Under African Skies is my like underrated, low-key best song, like my favorite one. It's not actually my favorite, and I don't actually think it's the best, but I think it's the most underrated is Under African Skies. That song is so good.
I've got three that really stand out for me, and it is Graceland, the song.
Yeah, of course.
Dear
that goes
Lord.
Without saying. Graceland, the song, that goes
Dear
without saying. Dear
Lord, I love that song.
It's one of my favorite songs ever of any kind.
My actual number one song, favorite song on this record, though, Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes. That I
it's
have
perfect.
Had stuck in my head in the less than 24 hours that I've heard this record.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, honestly, like the whole thesis of the entire album idea is like contained within that song. Like they do Ladysmith Black Mambazo like intro thing, and then it's like amazing African groove kicks in, and it's like it is a Paul Simon song, but it's like reinterpreted by these. It's just like it's amazing. It's the whole. If you need an idea of like what this album's about, just put on it. Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes contains the entire thing, right?
Yeah,
it's the entire thing. Right.
And it also has another big aspect, which is all of the New York session musicians who came in for overdubs, right? All those horns, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And
I would say the third one for me, the third one is for me is Homeless, but and we already talked about why that one's special, and we haven't talked about Call Me Al. And the reason I would say Call Me Al is like a little, like might just miss my like notable mentions. It's a great tune. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing pop song. The video for it was great with Chevy Chase and all that.
Chevy Chase, pretending to play the horns and stuff.
It's an amazing track, right? But I think that they got a little too excited when they heard it as a hit pop song. And what they did production-wise with those big, giant synths, that synth part, dun-dun-dun-dun, that's a guitar part. That's a Peary guitar part.
It's so iconic.
It's so iconic.
It works so well, man.
It does. I'm not even saying it's bad. Oh. I'm just saying that, like, what I wish they did was they went like 10% less pop and 10% more lean into the African thing. But I think that they recognized, rightfully so, that that was going to be a huge song. And so they really dressed it up more so than the other songs,
with
modern like production shit, because they heard money. They heard a cash register go cha-ching.
Yeah. In my opinion, it was the right move.
Yeah. It's great.
But yeah.
Clearly, what do I know? That song is like a bajillion dollar song, right? Like, if I was the one that was like, make it less appealing, actually.
But it makes sense. And I do get what you're saying, which is that, like, that they...
It strays from, like, the album edict, the idea, a little bit.
Because the finished product with all that production on it, it does have the effect of kind of disguising the heart of the core band sound that is inside there, which is really strong.
Okay. I think we should save the rest of any lyrics discussions or whatever for the bonus episode.
Oh.
That you can totally get on Patreon if you go to
Patreon.
Patreon.com/blackmarketdub. We will talk a little further about some other stuff that we didn't have time to get to today with Graceland. But I guess to wrap things up, Brandon, final thoughts, and would you recommend Graceland?
Yes, I would definitely recommend that you listen to Graceland if you've never listened to it before. It's one of the greats, you know. It is like, you know, it's one of the all-time greats in the pantheon, and it's a very unique album, and you can learn a lot. I think that's kind of like part of the legacy of this album, is that no matter who you are and no matter how much you know about music and you know, your own culture's music or whatever music it happens to be that is your bag, is your thing, like, the world is full of all kinds of other music that you are a baby to it.
Right. There's always something to learn.
There's so much more to learn. There's
Paul Simon in his 40s understood that.
Yeah, and all these other musicians involved in this, you know, they're established, like, dudes who spent their whole lives specializing in something.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, American songs have a minor chord. Isn't that interesting, you know?
Yep.
But, yeah, it's just, it's a very cool kind of musical object, because it's guaranteed, no matter who you are, you're going to learn something when you listen to it. You
know,
you're going to be exposed to something that is new, and it's so darn catchy and accessible. it's not behind a nerdy wall of that you need to know a lot about music in order to understand it. It's like anybody can tap along and hum along and sing along to this and get these melodies stuck in your head for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's amazing. What about you? Final thoughts? Would you recommend?
Yes. Well, not only would I recommend it, I'm like, it's like enthusiastic recommendation. And like, I'm embarrassed to say that I'm like so new to this music. But I mean, like I said at the beginning of the episode, I listened to it for the first time yesterday. And I listened to it, I listened to it two more times and just did a little reading about it. And I just, I'm like overcome with like the hype was real on this one. Like the hype was real on this one. So yes, I would enthusiastically. Yeah,
it deserves its reputation.
It does. Yeah. And I would even go like beyond that. Like its reputation is mostly as like just a fantastic album, right? Like a quintessential, one of the great albums of all time. Mm-hmm. And I would agree with that. But on top of that, the added dimension of, you know, the cojones it took to make this, to go to South Africa during apartheid and to make this fucking record with all, and with all the adversity he faced, he got so much shit for this record, like so much. And like shit that like, if it was levied at someone today, it would break you. Like it's so hard to defend, the decision that he made to break the cultural embargo and go make this. But the net effect of that bravery was actually, I think this album was instrumental in helping dismantle apartheid. Ooh, I really do feel that
that's
way.
That's a good, I haven't really thought about that. I feel like investigated that much. Yeah, did Graceland play some role in apartheid ending? Wow.
I mean, like literally, no, but culturally, absolutely. Culturally, like absolutely. Like bringing these African musicians to the world stage and by result, like elevating the cause of ending apartheid.
Exactly. Because it
to,
makes
like,
it
a
human.
Global audience.
It makes it human. It makes the people who are suffering from the institution of apartheid different than faceless people on the news and in headlines. And it's like you listen to this album, you love this album, you see their names, Ray Peary, Bigidi Kumalo, Ladysmith Black Mambazo, Joseph Shabalala, like this is amazing.
Are they going
like,
to get like clubbed
you mean
death
to tell me
cops?
That these guys are not allowed to, you know, like these guys are behind these, you know, it makes you feel, it makes it more human. It makes you feel like you know people who are oppressed by apartheid, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think just like the global phenomenon that this became, I think must have helped elevate the cause of ending apartheid in so many more people's minds, people that didn't even know what apartheid was or what the deal in South Africa was. Yeah. I have no doubt that this elevated that cause more than any kind of boycott ever could. And it's because art and music is more powerful than rules and laws. It just is.
See, I love this, man. I love this freedom fighter that's coming out of you, man.
Well,
I want to see more of this. This
well,
is good.
That's how I really feel. Okay, good. So we'll talk more about this on the bonus episode. If you want to hear more playback, please visit our Patreon page for exclusive episodes, bonus content, videos like this one at patreon.com/blackmarketdub. We are also a band. All the music featured on this episode and in every episode is available to stream for free on Bandcamp at blackmarketdub.bandcamp.com.
Mm-hmm. And please, you know, drop a like, drop a comment, click a subscribe, all that. It helps us.
Do all the stuff.
Yep.
Do all the stuff you're supposed to do to make your podcast, your favorite podcast, go to the top of the charts.
Exactly.
Do all that stuff.
You know what to do.
Yeah. All right, Brandon.
Okay, Nate.
That was very fun. Thank you for picking such a great album. If you want to hear what album we're picking next, that's another reason to go to the Patreon, because we're about to talk about it. I have one picked out, and I can't wait to tell Brandon what it is.
I'm very curious. Okay, well, so long, everybody. We love you, and I have reason to believe that we all will be received in Graceland.
Woo! Thank you.